Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. It's Friday, so time for our week in review. As the federal government shutdown stretches into day 21, furloughed federal workers and some essential workers still on the job are missing their first paychecks. At a rally in Boston today, furloughed workers like Kevin Elliott vented their frustration about the stalemate.
The wall thing, I just don't understand how that's holding up everyone getting paid. It feels like people are being held hostage over politics.
Senator Ed Markey condemned President Trump, saying the president is harming families.
The president is using ordinary families of federal workers as pawns, as hostages in a larger game for a border wall, which every security expert says will not work.
But during his visit to the border, President Trump blamed the gridlock on congressional Democrats who refused to fund his border wall.
The government shut down because Democrats will not fund border security, plain and simple. And again, more than just the walls. Their open borders agenda threatened all American families.
So, can a deal be reached to end this shutdown? Well, joining me now is Joe Battenfeld. He's a columnist at the Boston Herald and host of Battenfeld on Boston Herald Radio. Hello, Joe.
Great to be here.
Also with us is Marie St. Flour. She is a former Massachusetts state representative and now a principal at St. Flour Communications. Hi there, Marie.
It's good to be here.
Hello. So, Joe, this partial shutdown will almost certainly become the longest in U.S. history tomorrow,
right?
Longer than the 21-day shutdown of 1995. How much longer do you see this dragging on?
I see it could go on weeks, months, even, the way it's going right now. I mean, depending on what the president decides to do with his emergency declaration powers. But if he decides not to do that or decides not to link it somehow to the shutdown, then there seems to be no end in sight. I mean, you look at both sides. Did you see any room for compromise anywhere the other night when they both gave their speeches? It was ridiculous. Both sides were so far apart. There was no room for compromise anywhere. So I don't think either side has left itself any wiggle room at all.
Well, to that point, Maine Senator Susan Collins told NPR today that it's very difficult when we're dealing with people who do not want to budge at all in their positions, right? So we heard House Speaker Nancy Pelosi say recently that the wall is an immorality. That would seem to leave little room for compromise. The president, Marie, seems willing to maybe change the materials, you know, maybe build out of steel instead of concrete, but really not budge on the wall. So do you have any more optimistic forecasts than Joe? Do you also see this stretching on for a long time to come?
I see this stretching on unless, of course, the Senate decides that it's a co-equal branch of government and decide to do exactly what pass the bills that they had already agreed on with bipartisan support and marshal its members to be ready to overcome the president's vetoes. And I think at the end of the day, the Congress will begin to feel this as well. So somebody needs to step up, and I don't see the president moving.
So the president has flipped here. I remember at the outset he said that he would be proud to shut down the government.
Yes.
He said he would take ownership of it. He's changed his mind, of course, and now he's blaming Democrats. But does he have a point, Marie? I mean, couldn't the Democrats just throw him his $5.7 billion? It's a drop in the bucket of a $4 trillion federal budget. Just give him his wall and maybe buy, you know, a path to citizenship for Dreamers.
But the reality is, one, it's a false argument that the president is raising. All the data shows that really continuing to build a wall is not a solution to solving the issues of immigration in this country. We also know from all the data that there are other ways. I mean, the world has advanced besides a wall. There's all sorts of technology. There's sorts of surveillance, diversion that works in order to that have continued to work and have been working effectively to reduce illegal immigration at the borders. And so to give him, almost $6 billion to spend on a make-believe wall is not the best way to spend our tax dollars. Moreover, they did give him some money, and I don't recall the exact dollar amount, but he's been given a few billion dollars already to work on that wall, and he didn't spend that money on the wall. So we know that he just wants money to play, monopoly. He wants monopoly money to play, not really to solve the problems that face the people of this country, which is really they need to buckle down and provide this country a clear pathway to good immigration policies in order to for us to be able to move forward.
Yeah, the president wouldn't sign that initial spending bill pass in the Senate that would have had some funding, but not as much as he wanted. Joe, is there a compromise here, though, maybe to get the government back open? The president's been talking all week about the possibility of using emergency powers to build the wall. I mean, could that be sort of a workaround? You open the
government back up? That could be an out for him. It could be an out for him because he could just declare, okay, I'm going to do this on my own and apply this emergency money to the border wall and then say, okay, and then release the money to keep the government running. He could do that. And in fact, I think that would be best for him politically to do that because in that way he can say, okay, I at least gave a little. I reopened the government. I put these people back and gave these people their paychecks back and blame Democrats for not moving on it at all. And then, of course, it's going to get held up in the courts, whatever he decides to do with his emergency declaration money. Well, but then he can just say, oh, the liberal courts are holding me up. So I think there is a political way out for him of this. And I do think it's the fault of both sides that there has been no agreement on this. Democrats are doing this because it's politically expedient for them to say all of a sudden the wall is immorality when in fact people like Chuck Schumer have approved money before for a border fence or wall, whatever you want to call it. So I think both sides could move on this, and they're just not because it's politically expedient for them to do otherwise.
So if the president were to exert his emergency powers, what exactly would that look like? Well, NPR is reporting today that one option on the table would be using money from the Army Corps of Engineers, perhaps to divert money from existing projects, things that perhaps could be put on hold. Not disaster relief, but that's something that could hit us here. You know, Massachusetts has 10 Army Corps of Engineer offices around the state. And we spoke with Congressman Joe Kennedy earlier this week about the prospect of an emergency. He told Radio Boston that such a move would be an unprecedented power grab.
He probably has the authority to do it. Does that mean it will withstand legal scrutiny? No, it doesn't. And that is very much up in the air. And certainly, even if he might have the legal authority to do it, should he do it? The answer to that is absolutely not.
And just one update on that. The president, just in the last moments, has said that he is not going to declare a state of emergency immediately, but he's hoping that perhaps Congress will do its job. Joe, what do you see there? I mean, the president seems to be a little bit stuck because even if he does get his wall one way or the other, it doesn't sound like Mexico is paying for it, and it's not coming as quickly as he promised. Do you think he can still satisfy his base if he gets it anyway?
I do think he can satisfy his base. If he delivers the money for it, I think people, delivers the wall in any way, shape, or form, whatever you want to call it, a steel or fence or whatever you want to call it, some form of a wall is what his supporters want. And I think that's what he promised them. Of course, the whole Mexico thing is out the window. Getting Mexico to pay for it is out the window. But I think if there is some form of a wall, I think people will be appeased by that.
And to your point, in an NPR Ipsos poll this week, 2/3 of Republicans did say that the president's speech on Tuesday night helped convince them there is, in fact, a crisis at the border and a need for the wall. So that's only a slice of Republicans, and that's not the whole public, but that is the base that perhaps he's speaking to.
Exactly.
Marie, let's talk a little bit about the human toll here, because just yesterday on Radio Boston, we had Mike Gazagian in. He's a TSA officer at Boston Logan Airport. He's also the acting president of Local 2617 of the American Federation of Government Employees. And he made this comparison about the government shutdown.
If this were, let's say, a public company where the board of directors and the CEO get into a fight over what kind of security system to put in their buildings, and they shut down their business and, you know, laid off all their workers, the shareholders would not accept that. Shareholders would throw them out right away. And this is kind of a similar situation here. So we really have to get the public involved, and, you know, they have to step up and say, you know what, we're not going to tolerate this. This is ridiculous.
So how about that, Marie? It seems an apt comparison. This is the businessman president, after all.
Well, he's the businessman president, but the reality is the government is not a business. And I know we'd like to make those comparisons, but unlike the private company that can actually lay off its people and disperse them everywhere, unfortunately, if you are working for the federal government and you're an essential employee, you are required to work. You can't, there is not just this idea that you can just go home and sit or go find another job. You are required to show up. TSA is required to show up. border security is required to show up. A lot of our emergency supports are required to show up. So it is not the same. And unfortunately, you know, there's two ways of looking at this shutdown. He is holding his base. Yes, this is red meat for the base. The 30% that loves him no matter what he does, he's right. And that is the president of the United States, right? He's right. He's using the he doesn't care that he's using the federal employees as a pawn in this game that he's playing, because in his mind, the federal employees are all Democrats. So it's okay, as long as he essentially says, you know, that's who they are. So that's okay. But there's something a little specious about this whole argument that this president raises. What is that wall? What is the symbol of that wall? It really talks about the fact that the people who are on the other side of the wall, the folks who he sees as the other, that he really is throwing meat at to really sow dissension, continually to sow dissension in this country. And that is what that wall represents. It is that structural barrier that speaks about the other. And this is his way of keeping his base captivated at no matter what the cost is. And I think the Democratic Party and the independents and all others who really care about the direction of this country need to stand up and essentially tell Congress, particularly the Senate, step up, do your job, vote. You're getting paid every week, unless, like other Americans, the other folks who are federal employees, you're still able to take care of yourselves. Regular American families cannot put food on their table now. They can't get health care to take care of themselves, and they can't really survive. So we need to really ask Congress. I think it's really about the House and the Senate sitting down, working out a deal, getting the right votes. Each of them can count. You know, Mitch McConnell knows how to count and get his members to step up and be ready to override any vote. We don't need a wall that's going to essentially cost you $28 billion. $6 billion is just a down payment, all right? What could $6 billion do for kids in school, for health care, for early education and care? You're talking about a wall that's essentially going to cost you almost, for maintenance, the first decade will cost you, I want to say, somewhere around $48 billion. What could we do with our infrastructure with $48 billion to support our own programs, policies, roads and bridges in states across this country? And excuse me, he wants to tell the Corps of Engineers to figure out where they're going to find the money. We have our infrastructure across this country is falling apart. And you want to take money from the little bit of money that we have in order to put toward a wall that every expert tells you does not make any sense. So again, we have to ask the co-equal branch of government to step up, represent all of us, and get us moving.
Well, if it does come to the Army Corps of Engineers, no doubt there'll be a lot of scrutiny of which projects the money is being diverted away from. So something for us to keep an eye on. But you mentioned education funding in there, Marie, and I do want to get to that point. On the state level, in local news this week, we had Boston's Mayor Marty Walsh signaling his support for a reform for the way the state doles out education money to cities. He was on Radio Boston earlier this week, and this is what he said about it.
Something has to be done here. This is something that's drastic. It's about the future of our young people. And working off a formula that's 26 years old just doesn't work anymore.
Now, the mayor is getting behind a bill filed by State Senator Sonia Chang Diaz. She's trying, yet again, to increase funding for public schools.
Every year that we fail to get this done, we are accepting another class of economically disadvantaged children graduating through our system without access to arts programming, or computer science, or foreign language classes, or a soccer team, or a school psychologist.
Governor Baker is expected to file an education bill of his own in the coming weeks. He also says the formula used to calculate how much state aid a city receives needs to be updated. So, Joe, there may be different strategies here, but there does seem to be some bipartisan agreement that this education funding formula is outdated. And I'll just try to summarize it quickly for us so we understand. In short, it calculates a city's need for state aid by looking at how much tax revenue the city collects. Boston collects a lot of tax revenue, so the formula thinks Boston doesn't need very much aid. The mayor's complaining about that, and he's saying that we need to get more money out of this formula. Does he have a point?
Boston does need more money from this, definitely. I think the mayor has a point. He's coming to it a little bit late in the game, I think. But I think because the legislature has been, the Democrats in the legislature have been leading on this But I do think that there are going to be different strategies on how you get the funding. It's not going to be just everybody agreeing and nicely and saying, okay, we got to deliver more money. Governor Baker is going to demand that other reforms get tied to this money. And so there's not just giving money without any strings attached to it. He's going to demand some strings attached to it. And I think that the Democrats in the legislature are going to resist that. So I think we are going to have some problems. It's not just going to be an easy passage.
I think when you say he's late to the game, you may be referring to the fact that Sonia Cheng Diaz had a similar bill like this
exactly.
in the last session, which he sort of sat out.
Right.
When he was on our air this week, of course, he's looking out for Boston in particular, but he argued that the education bill would be a positive thing for the entire state.
It's not just Boston. This is many cities and towns across Massachusetts. Ultimately, this bill lifts all cities and towns for education funding. It's something that is desperately needed.
So, Joe, what do you hear when you say Mayor Walsh? I hear Mayor Walsh say that. Is he broadening the appeal of his argument or broadening his own appeal?
Well, I think he has taken steps clearly recently to broaden his appeal statewide. Whatever that means, running for Senate maybe in the future, maybe running for governor in the future, he's definitely taken some steps to broaden his appeal. So I think while it does certainly benefits the Democrats in the legislature by him getting on board, it also benefits him as well.
And Marie, if the mayor is behind this version of the bill, is that a difference maker? Because Sonia Cheng Diaz's bill in the last legislative session got through one chamber but not through the other, and it lacked the support of the mayor and the governor. So is having Walsh on her team this time going to be enough to push over the finish line?
I mean, I think it's always good to have the mayor of Boston on your team when you're trying to move a piece of legislation, particularly in the issue of advocacy and elevating the issue. I think it's really important. Though I do want to say, in his defense, having served with the mayor when he was in the legislature, that this is not an issue he is new to, and those are issues that he voted on as a legislator from Dorchester, that those are issues that he championed. And I also, having worked in the mayor's office, not under his leadership, but we understand that each mayor sets an agenda, and there was an early education and care agenda that he had set that year that he is trying to push through that actually he did not get any traction on, and we know that it's really important that we invest in children earlier. And so apparently filed, and I have not seen it, a new legislative package, and that is part of that legislative package that he has filed. All that being said, I'm glad that he's on it. The issue of increased funding for education is critical, and I'm glad the mayor is on board, and other mayors have to be on board as well. The Mass Education Partnership have been talking about this for a long time now, because we've talked about Massachusetts is number one for some. So it's not simply an issue for Boston. When you disaggregate the numbers and look at it, we're always talking about how well Massachusetts is doing in education. But when you really disaggregate the numbers and really get down to it, there's certain populations in Massachusetts where children are not doing well at all. And we really need to figure out where we invest equitable investment that would allow these students to get to the starting line in order to have a chance. And so, yes, I believe it has to be accountability. If you're going to put more money, you have to make it more accountable. But if we're going to talk about accountability, we need to figure out how that's really going to reflect in the classroom where the kids sit, where it will have the most impact. So I'm glad everybody's looking at the issue of education. Increased funding, Chapter 70 is outdated, and it is time for it to be revamped. But we need to make certain that it is revamped within the context of equitable access to a quality education in Massachusetts for all children.
Just to put a figure on it, you say we got to spend more on education. This latest version of the bill could cost $1.5 billion. Here's another figure that really stood out to me this week, although perhaps it shouldn't have surprised any of us. There are only 16 female firefighters in the entire city of Boston on a force of 1,500. We got that figure from a new city commissioned report that identifies what it calls a male-dominated culture within the fire department with widespread, quote, locker room talk, familiar phrase from the president there. Boston Mayor Marty Walsh says the city needs to recruit more women to the force. He spoke about it with CBS Boston.
Ultimately, it comes down to really creating more opportunities. I mean, when you think of a fire department that has, you know, 1,500 firefighters, 16 women, it makes it really difficult, challenging. I mean, I don't care what environment you live in or work in. That's a big number. That's a big difference.
Some, including Boston City Council President Andrea Campbell, tell Boston Radio that recruitment efforts are not enough.
But if we really want these departments to be reflective of our current demographics, it cannot just be a couple of initiatives. It has to be comprehensive, and we have to look at civil service.
Now, Marie, the Boston Fire Commissioner Joseph Flynn says his department is making progress toward diversifying. The incoming class of 54 recruits includes 20 racial minorities. That's more than a third. It's the most since 2003. But there's still just one woman out of those 54. Can there be real change in the firehouses without more women in the ranks?
You know, incremental change, right? I mean, this is not the first time that the fire department has been in the news or the issues of diversity, of inclusion have come up. It's not simply under Mayor Walsh. It predates, right? And so to some extent, we do have to look at all the tools in the box. So the idea that we continue to work on recruitment, I think that's great. I think that's one tool in the box, but we have to take a look at all of this. I always have to say, you know, we have a system. Things just don't happen by accident. We created a system that has allowed for this lack of diversity, lack of inclusion of women to happen. And so we need to go back and take a look at the structures that are currently in place, and civil service is one of them. You know, we shouldn't get it. Everybody gets really personal about this. Sometimes we have vehicles that exist that we've either by just benignly or actively causes some of the problems that we are experiencing. And if we are going to be honest about solving the problem, we have to look at all of it and really do a fair assessment. Civil service was not something that sort of Moses came down from the mountains and landed and said, okay, thou shalt have civil service. Somebody thought that there was a problem and made civil service the tool in order to correct the problem. Now we're saying that it has had a disparate impact in some populations. And so the question is not about getting rid. It's really looking at it, analyzing it. Councilor Campbell is not the first one to raise that issue. That whole issue has been looked at as it relates to the police department. I think if we go back and take a look at old cases, we'll find that this issue has elevated itself. So let's stop talking about it. Take a deep dive. Let's do the analysis and figure out whether or not there's any there. If there is, let's do something about it. If there's not, let's figure out another solution. But again, 16 out of 1,500? Come on. I mean, It speaks for itself.
But changing the civil service exam system can't be tricky, though, right, Joe? Because you've got a lot of people who score highly, they achieve highly, and the way we structure it right now, there's a preference given to veterans, which has some merit on its own. But of course, that is a very heavily male pool. So by changing it, creating one new problem to fix another one?
In fact, the whole civil service system was put in place to get politics out of it, because mayors were abusing it, so they put it in place so the patronage wouldn't exist. So there are noble reasons, actually, for civil service for why it was put in place. And I don't think you can just scrap it. But I do think it certainly can be looked at, and certainly there are too few women on the firefighting force. Those numbers are incredibly low and should be higher. And in fact, they are doing a better job of recruiting minorities to the police department and the fire department. But I think more could be done there as well, because in fact, Boston is now a majority minority city, and a third is not enough. A third racial minorities is not enough. They need to be making a better recruitment effort, I think, especially with women.
All right, let's try to squeeze in our hubbubs. These are the brief stories or events that caught our attention this week and deserve a shout out. Joe, what do you have on your mind this week?
Well, the next time you have a penny in your, somebody gives you a penny and you just stick it in your pocket, you might want to check that penny, because a Pittsfield man who had a penny he'd been keeping since 1947 sold at an auction this week for $200,000. It was an all bronze penny, and apparently they didn't make very many of them. $200,000 for a penny. I'd say that's a good return on your investment. Unfortunately, the man died last year and was not able to cash in on it, but he did make sure that the money was donated to the local library. So I think next time you get a penny, and you might want to check check it.
That's quite a windfall, though. Yeah. Perhaps not the most reliable retirement plan. Marie, what's your hubbub for the week?
Mine is an invitation. King Boston and the Boston Foundation are sponsoring a teach-in on economic justice on the occasion of the 90th birthday of Dr. Martin Luther King. That is happening at the Arlington Street Church. It starts at 3 p.m. We want everyone to come down if you're really concerned about closing the income gap, if you're concerned about economic justice and really want to have a conversation about what our city will look like in the next 15 to 20 years. Great time to have a conversation with Professors Tommy Shelby and Brandon Terry from Harvard University, who are scholars of Dr. King, and we are delighted that Paul English has created the space for us to be able to have this conversation and also to drive the creation of a memorial honoring Coretta Scott King and Dr. Martin Luther King on our wonderful Boston Common.
All right. Thanks for the invitation, Marie, and thank you for being here. That's Marie St. Flour, a former Massachusetts state representative and now a principal at St. Flour Communications.
Thank you.
And Joe Battenfeld, political columnist for the Boston Herald and host of Battenfeld on Boston Herald Radio. Thanks, Joe.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Callum Borchers. This is Radio Boston.